Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to Self-Publishing, Inspiring Young People with Marine Biology, Being a Northerner from the South, Rummaging Through Victorian Rubbish Dumps, amongst other things. Got your brew ready? Great! Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Coffee and Geography podcast. We're back again. We're really underway with season 4 now, well into the way of 2024 by the time of listening. And I'm joined with someone I'm speaking on a podcast for the second time, because this is not the first time we've chatted. Andrew Kane, nice to see you again.
No, it's not. I'm looking forward to it, Kit.
Yeah. So the first time we chatted actually was for the Reteach project, which folks of this podcast should know a bit about. But if you don't, there is a previous episode from last season. You can go and listen to all about the Reteach project, especially if you're an educator, a science or a geography educator. And that's kind of what you are, Andrew. You are you're a science teacher, I believe.
I am, yes, for my applied geography. Sins, yes. Not geography, unfortunately, no. No, I was originally a biology teacher, but then they run out of physics teachers, and so I've been doing that for 10 years now.
Oh, so you've kind of like come into my neck of the woods then, because my background's all in physics and atmospheric physics and stuff like that. So, Okay, well, then I end up being a geographer. So it's all cross-pollination anyway, really, isn't it?
They moved me to the dark side.
And Andrew, you have the shortest bio that anyone has ever sent me. So, folks, here's the introduction to Andrew. Andrew Kane is a teacher, an idiot, and likes a laugh.
That's it.
That's it. That's all you wrote.
It. There's no need for any more. I like a laugh, and I'm a teacher. Full stop.
Well, on the basis of our last discussion, it really was quite. A laugh, definitely. I mean, the Reteach podcast, folks, is a little bit more formal than the Coffee and Geography podcast, but we somehow managed to have a few giggles even in that one, didn't we? So, folks, you get ready for it, because there's gonna be some fun things to listen to here. But you did give me a bit more information, so I will give that to folks. So, if the name is familiar to you, folks, is that Andrew's actually wrote 3 books. As he's put it, to help people without a scientific background understand the amazing life beneath the waves. And you've got 3 up there, which you can get access on all kinds of platforms, not just the big Jeff Bezos one. But speaking of that one, you're highly rated. You're doing really well. I mean, you're, I think Marine Biology, which is your second of your book of your third series, I think it wasn't it like got to number one of the category of the sellers list on Amazon.
It did, yeah. I was very chuffed about that. Yeah, quite happy. Well, obviously, over the moon when that happened. I didn't think it would happen, but it did.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll talk a bit about that a bit later in the podcast, folks. So about Andrew's books, but the one in particular that's seemed to gain a lot of traction, the one you've done really well on, is the second edition, Marine Biology for Non-Biologists, and you've got 423 reviews. And you've got an average of, well, almost 5 stars. So, you know, that's not bad. You always have to look, when you see these things, you've got to be in the hundreds or more with reviews, haven't you, before you trust them.
It's yes.
Like, yeah, you just be getting all your friends and family to write reviews.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got about 500 mates.
We're definitely of the same ilk, really, because it's both of what we do is try and communicate science to people without a scientific background. So myself with climate change and that respect, and yourself with oceanography, marine biology, and stuff like that. And you run a marine biology club for year 10s, which is really interesting, because when you think of school clubs, extracurricular activities and stuff like that, of course you get your geography club, your history club, you know, music, you know, maybe you've got a little bit more specialist things like board games, chess club, whatever like that. But I don't think it's that common, actually, is it, to have a marine biology club? That's pretty cool.
Well, I'm really chuffed with it. I mean, we started it last year, and it's been something I've been wanting to do, And so I thought, why not? I'll pass it by the head, see what they feel. And you've got to remember, we're in Warrington, and we serve a very deprived area. So a lot of these children, the only time they're seeing the sea is from an arcade in Blackpool. You know, that's
right.
It.
Yeah.
You know, so never mind knowing what an animal is or what a coral is or anything like that. So we had a go and went round and publicised it in the school. And lo and behold, we had a load of them come down. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was fantastic. And so we went through all the biology, all the oceanography. They just lapped it up. They worked really hard. But then at the end of it, we took them down to the School of Ocean Sciences in Bangor.
Oh, wow.
And so they had a day out in the university. And, of course, these are year 10s. So they've never seen the inside of an ocean science lab or anything like that, or growing plankton in big buckets and things. Yeah. And then we took them down. We caught some zooplankton, took it back to the labs, did some – they could identify the species through the microscopes. Then they did some fluid experiments, saw how the water stratifies with temperature and everything. And then we all went home, and it was brilliant. It was absolutely amazing. I've got to thank the university for that. And we'll be doing it again this year.
Oh, that is what an experience for those kids. Oh, yeah, I want to talk a bit about the Warrington area a bit more detail in a minute, but let's keep going on that. So Bangor is, I mean, if you look at a map of the UK, I mean, it doesn't seem to be that bad, you know, that hard to access from where you are, but I'm guessing it's a whole world away for these kids.
Oh yeah, really? absolutely really? They've hardly ever go out of Warrington, a lot of these kids.
That's amazing.
They hardly ever go out of the area where they live, never mind going anywhere nice. So it blew them away, and you know, it's not their fault. You've always got to remember, it's not their fault where they live.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. Which is why terms like postcode lottery and stuff like that exist, don't they? So folks, if you're not sure, it's a good segue to where Andrew's actually lives and works. So if we start with Bangor first, Bangor University, that's in Northern Wales. And if you've got that large island that sits off the northwest coast of Wales, and that's the Isle of Anglesey, and kind of like Bangor is sitting kind of right there across the estuary. What I can't remember though, if it's on the west or the east side. I think it's the west. Is it the east side of the Menai Strait? I think.
Oh, it's off the west side.
Okay.
No, so, east side. I always think the east and west.
It's on the mainland. Yeah, side.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. And then the other side of that, you've got the Isle of Anglesey and stuff like that. And then you kind of, if you trace the road along the north coast of Wales, go past Llandudno, a place I've been to, it's a lovely place. And then you come to the Mersey Estuary, and you got Liverpool. And then you can see a big chunk on a map where you got Liverpool, and then you've got a little bit of space, a big chunk on a map where you got Manchester, and pretty much smack bang in the middle of those two conurbations is Warrington. So
there's Warrington.
Warrington. So tell us a little bit about, so you've already given us a bit of an insight then with regards to the students you teach. So yeah, tell us a little bit more about Warrington as a place, kind of like maybe based on the experiences that you've got with the kids there. And is there an identity crisis between Liverpool and Manchester?
Oh, but just a little bit. But if they're talking about Warrington, it's something, it rhymes, something, put a word in front of hole, that will get you, that'll get it right. Oh, God. No, it's a lovely place. I've lived here nearly all my life now. My mum and dad moved us up here when I was about seven, and we lived down south. And so I came up here being an avid supporter of West Ham United. And so of course, I've lived in between Manchester and Liverpool for all my life supporting West Ham. So I've had an hard life. But the Warrington itself is you know, it's like every place. There's some beautiful places and there's some not so beautiful places. You know, it's just like, it's just a northern town, fantastic rugby club, and really that's just a northern town, good place to live.
So when you've got, these kids then that come from Warrington, you say they've. Some of them don't even get. Do they even get the chance? It sounds like what you're saying, that like maybe Blackpool, if they're lucky and they can go out on a family day out or something like that, which is a little bit to the north. But they very rarely kind of venture into maybe even Liverpool or Manchester, as which even though they're kind of really up right there.
Not a lot of it. Not a lot of it will go on. There will again, you know, you've got the nice places in Warrington where, you know, their kids will be going all over the place and everything.
Indeed,
they'll be going abroad and everything. And then you've got other areas where a lot of them won't be going very far at all. It's not, you know, it's not horrible for them really. You know, they've got no life experience, and that's what we've got to try and give them, some experience in life rather than seeing what's out there rather than just what they're used to.
Yeah, and that's something that I think geographers and scientists can definitely agree on, you know, in our banter I can't even talk, Andrew, today. I'm not going to edit that out, folks. I like owning that. Competitiveness. There you go. Banterous competitiveness. That's what I was going for. So were you yourself then? You said you've been there most of your life. So I'm kind of like similar to you. I've not moved too far away from my route. So I'm originally from North London, Essex area. So talking to a West Ham fan here, and I'm a Tottenham Hotspur supporter.
No way!
Yeah, I know. And I've moved up to near Norwich. So I haven't gone too far away, but that is far enough removed for me to be, you know, something different from North London and whatnot. So, I mean, you definitely don't sound like you would have sound like me probably when we were both 7 years of age. We probably would have sound similar, but you've got a very strong accent now. And so perhaps apart from maybe your accent, is there any part of that kind of like Londoner that's still in you, or are you kind of like now like Northwest, you know, Merseyside, all that kind of stuff? You just feel it in your heart and soul. How is your where you live now?
The South has gone many years ago.
Okay.
Don't even remember it really. No, you could say I'm a Northerner. Although the Northerners would never admit that. They say no.
Ah, right. Yeah.
You've got to be here all your life. So hey ho, that's the way it goes.
So you can be 87, you know, living the bits of your life out. And you're like, as soon as they find out you've had those 7 years out of that 87 down south, you'll be like, nah, you're not a Northerner, lad.
That's it. It's like you're not an island. If you're not born on the island, you're not an islander.
That's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I've got one of my really, really like closest friends is from Liverpool, from Formby. And she says that, you know, she lives down here now, but she says that she will never kind of like have that kind of like Norfolk kind of part of her as strong as her Liverpudlian part of her. And she says that the way that people speak, it's like there is a lot of banter, a lot of friendly banter, but it's a lot of loving banter. She said, you don't quite get that down here. When somebody's making fun of someone down here, you don't really know if they're serious or not. You know, you're like, oh, hang on a minute, and you can take offense quite easy. She says, you go up there, you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. Does that sound about right to you?
Oh god, yeah. You've got to yeah, definitely. It's good sense of humor, basically, a really good sense of humor. And there's nothing, you know, a lot of the people, you know, just they live for it. You know, they just live for it because it's their escape. It's an escape as well. You know, but it's just the way we all are. But it's also, like I say, a whole northern thing, not just Warrington and Liverpool. I'd say, you know, you go over to Yorkshire, they're just the same.
Yeah.
And you go further up north, they're just the same. You know, it's just there is a huge north-south divide on that, I think. It's strange. It's a weird thing because there's no reason for it.
Yeah, no, you're right. And the other thing I've noticed as well is that the further north you get, it's almost like there's more of a carefree self-deprecation kind of going on, where people are more likely to without any shame make fun of themselves as well, but not to put themselves down, to kind of like, as in, you know, we just go with the flow with life, you know. And
I mean, we've got to take the piss out of ourselves, because if we don't, somebody else will. So that's the way we do it.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if there's I have no clue, folks, because this is complete speculation. This is not my expertise at all. But I'm wondering if there is like a historical basis in all that, the fact that the South had all the power, you know, and the control and the center of power was like London, all that kind of stuff, where you couldn't take yourself too seriously if you were away from that area, because you know, I wouldn't say you had less to live for, and that's not the right way of saying it, but maybe you had more carefree attitude, because down south they just want to keep hold of their, you know, their privilege, their power, their whatever, and they take themselves too seriously. Whereas the further away you got up towards up north, people are sod it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of it, I think that's a good one, because we've got the cotton mills, then you've got the miners, you know, and you know they worked hard. They worked really hard. That's where my family, you know, a lot of my family's is rooted in the mines. And so it was, you know, it was a hard life, a really hard life. And for the cotton mill workers and for all the other industrial workers of that era, going from 1850 to 1950. And so if they didn't make fun of themselves, or if they didn't have a laugh, their life would be really miserable.
Mm.
I think that's where it probably comes from.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as I say, folks, I'm not an expert in this. It'd be lovely if any of you out there have like studied that kind of concept or anything, then you should definitely get in touch. I'd love to talk about it more. So when you work with your young people, then you know, your biology club, your whatever like that, I mean, it must be, I mean, I remember having lots of fun with the students I used to teach, you know, because when you get to know them, especially when you've been in the same school for years, I mean, I was in the same school for 13 years, you really get to know the students, you get to know where that professional personal line is not to cross, where you can get up to it, you can have fun, you can have banter, but you really engage the kids. They really feel like you're treating them like a human being, and they get stuck in. What is your classroom like then in that respect? What is your biology club like? I mean, I can, knowing as much of you as I do now, it must be a riot sometime, surely.
Yeah, we have a bloody good laugh, but that gets results at the end of the day.
Yes.
You know, half of the time, well, not half the time, you know, obviously most of the time the learning, you know, but there is a lot of time for having a bit of a laugh. Well, a lot of a laugh with them, you know. Do they take the mickey out of me? I take the mickey out of them. But as you say, there is that line, and we both, you know, both sides know not to cross it.
Yep.
You know, but we do. We have a good fun. We have really good fun. It's the only thing that keeps me going to work, to be honest.
Oh.
If it wasn't, I'd be doing something else. And yeah. The little characters. They are the little characters. They've got old heads on them, but they are funny, you know. And they work hard, and it's nice to see them. There's nothing nicer than seeing them saying, "I've got that now, sir."
Yeah.
You know, and oh, is that what's that about? And stuff like that. You know, there's nothing nicer than that.
Yeah. Yeah, my favourite lessons have always been where you just go completely off-piste, and you're like your lesson plan gets thrown out the window, and then you know you get that feel. I mean, folks, if you're not a teacher, if you are a teacher, you'll recognise this. If you're not, trust me, this does happen. You just get that little spark, don't you, in the room where you're like, this is going somewhere. The lesson plan's out the window. This is going somewhere. They're engaged. They've fired up. They've got a spark. And then you end up kind of like having like brilliant discussions, which are on a relevant tangent, but the kids are taking it where they want to take it, you know. And then you can have a bit of fun with it.
That's one of the skills of being a teacher, I think, of being able to just alter everything when you're reading what's going on in the room.
Yeah.
And the kids love it as well, because they think, a lot of them think, that we've got one over on him now, he's not doing the lesson. But actually what they don't realise is that we are doing the lesson,
but just
in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's actually a brilliant kind of like segue onto your books, because your books on marine biology for the non-biologists, they use a lot of humour in them. And that is a very good way. Humour and storytelling are two very good methods of trying to communicate knowledge and understanding onto people who find it difficult to grasp things. So tell us a little bit about kind of like, first of all, maybe how, why do you feel, I'm going to just write these books, because obviously a teacher, you're in the job to kind of make the complex understandable, to make, you know, non-experts, you know, good at something or whatever. So what drove you to thought, you know what, I love this topic so much. I've got a year 10 by me and Biology Club. I take them down the banger. We have a good laugh about it. I'm going to write a book about it.
Didn't happen like that.
You have to tell us how it happened then.
I finished uni and, my good lady had put me through uni, so I was about 27, 28, living in Warrington, so I couldn't really take the studying any further. I had to sort of like start providing and paying for the mortgage and stuff like this. So I ended up on a farm, working on a farm, and it's a farm that I've known for many years. I used to work on it when I was a kid, and so at dinner time it was boring because they had an hour. And I'd eaten me butties by 15 minutes, and I was on my Todd. So I wrote it then. Wow. I just sat down and thought, what can I do with my time? I thought, I know, I'll write a book. And so I just sat down with a pen and paper, and no computer there, you know, and then just wrote it. Nice. And then when I'd get home in my spare time, I'd type it up and get it onto an electronic copy of it. And then it just lay there for years and years. And then I had a car crash. Oh. And so I was at home, and our huge, big online retailer came out with self-publishing. And I thought, you know, I'll have a go at this. I've got some time. I can't go work. And so we published it on a Kindle, because it was only Kindle in them days. And so I published it on a Kindle, and it went okay. And then a few years later, the paperback started, and that's a different story then. Mm. And the paperback went mad. And so then I thought, well, people like this, I'll do another one. And so did the ecology one. And then I thought, well, they like that one as well, I'll do another one. And so I did Incredible Oceans, and that's been the story of the three. And it's just, it's good. I enjoy it. It's good fun.
Wow. What? I'm going to have to look into this myself. I mean, I have so many ideas boiling out of my brains that I don't know. I mean, was it much effort to self-publish, or was it just really a case of you just submit the manuscript and it's just like it's there? Or
you've got to learn how they want it doing and get it all spelt correctly, because I'm dyslexic, so I've got to get all that sorted. But once that was sorted, then we just put it onto a PDF and uploaded it, and it worked.
Oh, yeah.
And we thought, wow, that was good. So yeah, it was quite interesting. Well, it was interesting how to do it, but it was easy as well. It was easy.
Are you a business or organization passionate about ethical practices, products, and systems? Is being sustainable, inclusive, and equitable core to your values? And do you want to spread the word amongst listeners who share these ideals? Then sponsor the Coffee and Geography podcast. There are pricing options to suit a range of needs, and you know you are supporting independent educational efforts that aligns with your aims. Visit bit.ly/coffeegeog/sponsor for more details.
I remember for the Reteach podcast, I kind of like talked about what was your kind of like the funniest stories, and you talked about, I don't want you to retell it because I want people to go and re-listen to that. I'll put a link in the description, folks, for Andrew and I's chat or for the Reteach podcast. But yeah, a really funny anecdote about how certain sea creatures like urchins just kind of like nonchalantly bulldoze through other sea creatures' homes, which is just amazing. So you've got, I'm just having a look at here now on that so-called website, and you describe the book for as, well, these series of books, particularly the non-biologist one, anyone from the age of 12 upwards will gain and understand the amazing life that exists between the ocean waves. So you've brought out, I'm finding it difficult to see what it says here, but you brought out, there's a second edition now of the Marine Biologist for Non-Biologists. So when did that come out?
Well, when it first came out, there was no illustrations on it.
Ah, okay.
And right. That was always bugging me. That was always annoying me. And then in COVID time, I got COVID. And so I was shipped off to this house, an empty house, to isolate. And so I was isolating in that house, and I was just looking around, and I started looking for illustrations. And then I came across these wonderful hand-drawn illustrations done by naturalists in like 1880 to about 1910 or 1920. And they're just absolutely gorgeous. And of course, they're free, you know, they're not unlicensed. And so I thought, oh, this is just absolutely perfect. And so I just redid it all, got the image, but then of course it's changed, so it has to be called a second edition. And so then we put that in, and yeah, it's made it so much better because them drawings are absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. I love them drawings. And it always gets me because, you know, you wouldn't think the person who was drawing that 100 years ago would have no idea they would be in a book 100 years later.
That's incredible, you know? Isn't it?
And I love that. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so, so incredible. And I'll tell you, illustrations make things a whole lot more accessible as well. I mean, as you know, as a teacher, I mean, what would you say, can you describe to us then maybe an illustration that maybe you came across and you were like, that's just amazing, and it really complemented your text very, very well. Is there any particular illustration you like, is perhaps your favorite in that second edition?
Probably the cuttlefish.
Okay.
There's a cuttlefish in there, and that was just, I can't describe it. It's beautiful. These illustrations, these illustrators from that period, they did it in a certain fashion, a certain way.
Yeah.
And it was the fashion of the day that you don't have nowadays. And so they're completely different to what anybody would ever publish nowadays. I think they're all gorgeous, to be honest. I've got to say they're all beautiful.
So I'm going to ask, I wish I asked this question for the Reteach podcast, but I did. So I'm going to ask it now, right? So,
I'm dreading this.
Okay. If there's any ocean, if you could be any ocean organism, what would you be and why?
Oh, God, what would I be? I'd be the immortal jellyfish because I'd never die.
Okay.
And he's a wonderful
pain in the backside for everybody as well. Creature.
Yeah, a wonderful creature. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think my favourite, God, what would it be? It wouldn't be a fish or anything like that. It would probably be a shrimp or something like that, a little boxer shrimp or a cleaner shrimp, so I could go inside the mouths of more eels and pick them teeth clean and stuff like that. Yeah, that'd be good.
You're not missing your calling as a dentist, are you?
God, no, you should see my teeth.
Oh. That is, I don't think I'd ever, I thought we were going to go like, oh yeah, maybe one of these, like, you know, big fishes, a whale or something. I was like, no, a shrimp. I love that. Oh, that has got to be the best answer ever.
Can't stand whales. Can't stand dolphins. Yeah. No, I do like them, but they get too much publicity, but they've got to get the publicity to get the money in for the organization. So yeah, that's but it's the little things I like.
Yeah. That's a good point. And of course, you know, things like shrimp, krill, all those kind of crustaceans, you know, they are an exceptionally important part of the marine food web. You know,
without them, there's nout.
Yeah. So one of the things that kind of like overlapping here, interdisciplinary with geography now, is that a lot of geography teachers will do things like the Antarctic food web and things like that, and something like Antarctica as a wilderness, and the older teachers among us may remember that we had a really cool decision making exercise exam which was all about Antarctica and the future of Antarctica and stuff like that, and I think krill became some of the kids' favorite actually creatures during that unit because they realized how integral they were to that ecosystem in the Southern Ocean and things like that. And it led to so many other facets, you know, not just of, you know, the fact that it influenced penguins and influenced, you know, kind of the way that phytoplankton would even, you know, how much of that was managed with bloomings and things like that, but also how it affected whaling and the whaling industry and things like that, and how climate change was kind of like changing all these patterns. And if you were to overfish krill, and then how that would unbalance the, it was just so interesting. We could have done a whole unit, Andrew, on just krill alone.
Really? I can imagine. Yeah, they are such an interesting little organism. I mean, the whales now, it's a fantastic story that the whales now are nice and got healthy populations. And there was a time when they thought that blue whales were going to be on an extinction vortex, but they weren't. Mm. So I think in a few years they'll all be gone. But now that all these whales are coming back, it means that the krill stocks are even more important.
Yep.
But the problem is that there are, a lot of them are in the Southern Ocean where there's no regulation.
Yeah.
And if there was regulation, you'd never get anybody going out there because it's so vast to try and enforce it. So, and krill are being taken more and more, are being taken every year. And there, again, there's only a certain amount.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not just Antarctica, the landmass that's inhospitable, that Southern Ocean with the roaring 40s and that circular southern ocean winds as well. And what people might not be aware of is that yes, we do have a treaty, the Antarctic Treaty, which kind of like safeguards that part of the world to an extent, but it doesn't extend into the ocean. It stops where the landmass stops, you know, so all the things about no military activity, scientific, you know, research only, you know, ecotourism only, all that kind of small footprint, no, you know, all that stuff that only extends as far as what I don't even know is that I had a good question asked by a student and I couldn't answer it. It was a really good question. They said, oh, does that include the sea ice? Because the sea ice is not land. I was like, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Is it just the land-based ice? I don't think it includes the sea ice as well, the Antarctic Treaty, because it's so it fluctuates so much. Can you imagine that being so you're absolutely right. Yeah, and it's you know, good news is that, well, bad news for us Star Trek fans is that means Star Trek 4 is never going to happen, because we're not going to need to go back and save the whales and bring them back to the future.
Yeah,
because they're all right now. But I can't imagine Star Trek 4 being rewritten to go and save a bunch of krill.
No. It would be fun. It could be army of krill with little machine guns or something.
There be krill. Yeah. Yeah. But you're spot on though. The little guy doesn't get the headlines, doesn't get the exposure. And yet it's the bottom feeders and the crustaceans which are so important.
Yeah, never has done, never will do. It's one of them things, unfortunately.
Yeah. So when you took these kids to Bangor then, and they did the, you said the phytoplankton stuff.
Zooplankton, yeah.
Right, okay. What did you notice that they got out of it? What appreciation do these young people get out of understanding what these small creatures were doing
We went down on the pier and started netting them, they were all just stood there going, you know, what are we doing here? What are we doing here, sir? What are we doing here? What else are we doing? You know, all stood there with their hands in the pockets, you know, and two or three of them got enough gump to actually get on the pier and start pulling the net and things like that. And so then of course we were just putting the bottles of water into the bucket. And looking in the bucket, they can't see anything, so they're not catching out. You know, going, well, just wait till we get back.
Wait till we get back.
And so then when we took them back into the labs, and then they started, you know, a pipette full of water into a Petri dish, you know, and then they were, what's going on here? Look at this. What's this? And it was pure amazement, pure utter Brilliant. Amazement. And of course, the university's got identification keys. So they were able to, you know, actually pin down different species of zooplankton and phytoplankton. So, yeah, it really was. You know, you call it a vision into the unseen world, but for them, it really was. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that's amazing. Right. So, folks, if you're a teacher and you're thinking of a very, I'm not, you know, niche is probably not the right word, but if you think of a very specific thing that you want to do a club on, God, do it. Do it, you know, and you know, marine biology might sound like a very, you know, what's great about that as well, Andrew, just what I think of it is that if you've got kids who, you know, kids in general, but especially kids, say, from a hard up background, hard up school, or whatever it is, you know, it's such a sadness that you would stereotype them and say, oh, you know, marine biology kind of thing club, but that's not for them, you know, which is
absolutely.
But no, you thinking that, folks, is exactly the reason why a club like a marine biology club should be in a school like that, you know.
Absolutely.
So that's brilliant. Yeah, good. Yeah, so folks, when Andrew gives contact details at the end, you know, might want to pick his brains a bit more on that and how we got on that. It's amazing.
Not a problem.
Now, you mentioned your sketches in your book. You're saying that some of them are like dating back to the Victorian times. I want you to spill the beans here, Andrew, because that's not the only kind of like Victorian thing that you enjoy, is it? So you apparently love to research where Victorian rubbish dumps are, and with permission, you've very clearly stated here, with permission, dig them up. Yeah. So yeah. This is, I'm looking forward to this. You call it a poor man's archaeology, but fun. So come on, tell us about this.
We're not archaeologists, are we? You know, we're just sort of like diggers. And you get these, it's nice because you get the old maps, you know, the maps from the 1850s, and then you've got the coal tithe maps, and then you get the 1900 census map and things like that. And you just look around the area, and you look for ponds, mate. I always look for ponds. And then you drive past and there's no pond there. It's been filled in. It's going to be a tip, probably. Ooh. You know, and then you contact the farmer. 5-9 times out of 10, they tell you where to go because, you know, and I can't blame them. Why would they want someone to come and take all this topsoil off, dig up their field, and then put it all back again? Why on earth would somebody actually allow you to do that? I've got no idea. But the odd one will. And then the other one is if you go out walking, and you're in the countryside and you come across some badger sets or some foxholes and things like that, you'll quite often see broken pottery where they've dug it up because they've dug their runs actually down into a tip. And so they've brought the pottery. So you note it in your head. And then you'll go back a year later. And if it's still, the set's still being used, you leave it. And then once it's stopped being used and it's all getting a bit overgrown, then you contact the landowner and have a go there. And yeah, normally it's good fun. And then you take the topsoil off and then the magic begins because what it is what they used to do, they used to have carts and it was like the old rubbish tip man, the rubbish man, you know, like we've got our bin carts. They had their bin carts, but their bin cart was a horse and a carriage. Yeah. And they used to go around the houses and the houses used to put all their rubbish. Now the main rubbish was cinders from the fire,
right,
and bottles that they've been drinking, and pottery, and things like that, and maybe the odd shoe. But there also you get a lot of oyster shells. Amazing how many oyster shells there is. Huh. And so then they used to take them away, and they used to just find areas, and they used to just empty the cart, and then they'd cover so much ground, then they'd cover it with topsoil. And then a farmer could farm it or it would be a field or whatever. And so then when you dig it up, that's what you're digging up. You're finding all the old bottles and you're finding all the old pottery and everything. And to me, it's weird because my mate bought a Harley Davidson. Yeah. And he really doesn't know how to ride a bike. Yeah. And so I was asking him, I said, right, you just spent 25 grand on a bike. You can't ride. And he went, I know, he says, but when I look at it, it makes me smile. So when I look at an old bottle, it makes me smile. And that's it. That's it. The wife thinks I'm potty. So do most of my mates.
Potty for pottery.
Yeah.
Oh, but I get it though. Cause like what you said here is like, if you gently excavating it from the soil and knowing that the last person to hold it was probably what in the mid 1800s, that's something, isn't it?
It's great. It's lovely. It's a lovely feeling. Yeah. And you know, when you're digging them up, most of them are broken. So yeah. you're digging them, and most are broke. So you don't expect to find many whole ones, and you don't. But when you do, it makes it all that special, you know. And then on the odd occasion, you'll have a magic day where some really rare stuff comes out, or you just get a lot of really nice stuff. They're the ones you can count one every 2 years, something like that. You know, they're the magic days. Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, we were digging out the bottom of our garden in Norwich when we first moved in there to put a small veggie patch in. We were lucky that we were living in we bought a two up, two down, but it was lucky that we had a long thin. I mean, the garden was only as wide as the house, so the garden was just like basically a long thin green corridor. Because it backed onto a prison in Norwich. So there was no land, there was no buildings or anything behind it. So we had a very long, narrow garden at the bottom, and it sloped downwards. And when we would dig in, because we wanted the water to drain and be irrigated, all that kind of stuff. So we put the veggie patch. And as we were digging out this veggie patch, we came across a lot of kind of old rubble, which we were wondering whether it was kind of like the remnants of when they were building all those housing estates in the late 1800s or something like that. And we found all sorts of things. I mean, mostly broken glass and broken brick. We had to be careful. We found something like, I couldn't really describe, but it looked like a spoon, but it was definitely very, very old. But instead of it being a round end we eat with, it was kind of like square. And we thought it was something to do like maybe a fire poker of some kind, or a fire, something that you use to turn your coals over. Yeah. Or take your ashes out with. So I was like, how old could this be? Because you'd never see anything like this nowadays. So we tried to look online and we said, like, yeah, you know, these things were probably in use like Victorian into the Georgian times. And it's like, so yeah, to pick that somewhere, I think the last person who's done that. So what, somebody's been excavating that area and like maybe just all the junk from all the old houses that they tore down, maybe just fill down the bottom of that hill. That's absolutely lovely. So you did it there, as we were talking about earlier in the podcast, isn't it, about self, you know, taking the mickey out yourself, right? Because I think a lot of people can understand how you feel when you see an old thing that maybe the last person to touch it was over, you know, 150 years old. I feel the same way when I look up in the sky at night, because I used to love astrophysics, stuff like that. And if I didn't become a geographer, I'd done that. And the fact that, you know, you look at the sun, not directly, but you see the sun in the sky and you know that you're actually seeing it 8 minutes in the past, that fills me with wonder, or the stars millions of years into the past because of the way that light travels, things like that. Is this, you know, it's the same kind of love, isn't it? It's like, wow, you got a bit of past there.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's lovely. Yeah. It's lovely, isn't it?
Mm. And it's complete. And I tell you, it opens up a new window to how, you know, the way that we've been treating the planet and how we've been disposing of things. And we know that the Victorians were very environmentally friendly, weren't we? You know,
so yeah, definitely.
but that's how we learn geography today and science today, isn't it? Is by looking at these processes in the past. So. No, I love that. Thanks for telling us about that. Have you got anything in your house? I mean, I'm not asking you to go grab it now or anything like that, but is there anything that you've managed to find you're like, this is gold, this is diamond, this is?
My favourite one, I mean, some of these things can be worth a very lot of money, but you don't do it for that. Yeah. My favourite one is one that wouldn't be worth a lot of money. It's an old gin bottle.
Okay.
Okay. From about 1840. Oh. And it's square. And when you look at it, when you look at the glass, you can see the wood where on the mold or whatever when it was first made.
That's amazing.
You know, and you can still feel it. That is, you can feel it as you rub the glass. You know, it's wonderful. It's very tactile.
Oh, that's amazing. And so when you're feeling that, you're thinking, you're not just got the bottle there that exists today, but you're feeling an imprint of something that maybe not exists anymore, that maybe exists for 200 years, because maybe they've been using them to make gin bottles for longer than that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're feeling the past. That's just amazing. Oh, brilliant.
The climate, energy, and cost of living crises has us all thinking about how we power our homes. If you're looking to switch for any of these reasons, see if one of Octopus Energy's tariffs is right for you. Octopus Energy are not sponsors of this podcast, but they do supply the energy to the house where it is made. If you make an informed choice to join Octopus Energy, use the referral code READFOLL15. That's READ, as in the plant, foal as in a young horse, and the number 15 to split 100 pounds. The split received by us will go directly towards continuing Gia Grambling's education efforts, like paying the subscription to maintain this podcast. If you missed that referral code, check the show notes for a link.
Oh, Andrew, we're gonna have to bring the chat, this wonderful, lovely chat, to an end, unfortunately. A couple of things to do though, because I'm not letting you go that easy. So what we're gonna do now is kind of link you back to our previous guest. So this is what we do for Coffee and Geography, is that we get guests linked to each other by a string of words, not quite like the old Bob Monkhouse thing, you know, which I've mentioned Bob Monkhouse so many times, and half the people don't even know who I'm talking about. But when he used to do that, you know, the story linking words with each other. So it's kind of similar to that. It's called We're All Geographers, where the previous guest comes up with a word or a phrase that you've got to speak for 30 seconds. And link it to geography or science, right?
Okay. Basically, well, this is bad.
Because, you know, science, geography is a science, and science is a geography. So I'm never gonna. I think geography is a STEM subject, Andrew. All right.
If I tell you something, if I'd have known this was happening, you wouldn't have got me on.
I gotcha. right. It's pretty straightforward though. So last week we had Shabnam Anam on, who did a wonderful job of trying to speak for 30 seconds about electrocautery.
What the hell is that?
Exactly, right? Right. And folks, you got to listen back to that podcast episode and the one before that, because it was given to her by Abigail Best, to know what the hell I'm talking about. I'll tell you after we finish recording, right? But Shabnam's giving you something that you're a little bit more familiar with. She's looking around her desk and says, okay, I'll give the next desk the HDMI. So the cable, HDMI, or the signal. Right. So basically, Andrew, you've got to talk for 30 seconds about anything you like about HDMI. Maybe it's maybe the pain in the backside you have with it at school.
Okay. Try and plug it. Yeah, that's exactly where.
So you ready?
Exactly where I was going to go with HDMI.
Are you ready? 30 seconds.
The bane of my life. I've thrown so many of those cables out of the door. And also a complete and utter ripoff. absolute pain. And I can't understand how people will fall for it. You know, you go into a well-known retailer and you buy a telly for $1,500 or £500 or whatever you buy a telly for. And then they turn around and say, would you like this HDMI, sir? It's only £68. What? You're taking the mickey. but people must actually buy them because they sell them at £68.
Well, yeah. Yeah, all for that extra 4K of resolution, yeah, or whatever. It is. Yeah.
The beautiful thing about the HDMI lead is not the HDMI lead itself. It's the bloody part you plug it into the telly can't reach.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got the HDMI, and the telly's on the wall. It's easy if it's not on the wall, because you can go behind. But if it's on the wall, you don't want to take it off the wall. You can spend half an hour trying to do it, and you'll still fail.
That's it.
Yeah, and don't like them. Don't like them. I think they should all be Bluetooth.
Fair dues. And also, folks, I mean, again, a lot of people listening are teachers, and I think a lot of them have got love-hate stories about HDMI cables. It's like, whenever I go do a talk at different schools, I say, oh, do you have a HDMI cable? I was like, no, we've still got VGA. I was like, yeah. But my laptop is like more than 10, is less than 10 years old. Come on.
Yeah. You know?
But I am going to say this one thing, though. You know what HDMI is good for? Programs like Planet Earth and Planet Earth 3 and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, gorgeous, gorgeous detail.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Fantastic. So, but that's okay now, because for our next guest, Dan, you get to come up with a word that the next guest can have a little rant about for 30 seconds.
Does it have to be a word, or can it be a couple of words?
It could be a couple. Yeah, it could be a couple.
Okay. Shopping trolley with a dicky wheel.
Okay, this is the first time ever. Yeah, because it's always been one word or two words, but shopping, but that's something specific, you know, like, yeah, a shopping trolley with a dodgy wheel. We'll have that. We'll have that. How our next guest is going to run with that, I have no idea.
But will you also apologise to them from me?
No, because I think it's hilarious. No, I'll pass that one. I'll pass that one. All right. So now I know that you don't do that Twitter nonsense, and good for you, because I don't do it much anymore. But if people want to say hi, get hold of you, or just see, you know, obviously I'll put the links in the description to about your books and stuff like that. But if people do want to connect with you, because you're a great guy, how could they get hold of you?
For the only one way, and there's only one way, and I always answer, it's my email. And that's simple. That's andrewmcaine@gmail.com.
Okay. That's, and you're happy Kane, for that to be out there, yep.
Yeah, that's Caine.
Okay, awesome. And have you got anyone else you'd like to say hi to?
Nope.
I guess that's the end of the podcast then, folks.
Okay, mate, sorry.
No. So, yeah, if you want to say, have a shout out to anyone, or say hi to anybody, your kids at the school, or...
Oh, well, okay then. Yeah, well, all the kids at school, all my fellow educators, whether they be in the school or whether they be or anywhere in the world.
Bless, yeah.
Because, yeah, they need a tap on the back every now and again.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's lovely. Well, I tell you what, Andrew, speaking to you again just reminds me about why, you know, I was a teacher and I still work in education, you know, because when we have passionate folks like you who love what they do, you know, bring in the life and soul and the joy in it, it's, you know, it whenever we have these kind of debates on the radio, on the TV stuff about teachers this, education this, school this, you know, it's you know, speaking to folks like you just reminds you of kind of like the people behind the desk doing that job and having these day-to-day interactions with the kids, where this might be some of the best interactions they might get in their day of their life. So yeah, this is absolutely lovely having you on and speaking to you again. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been great talking to you again, Kit. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.
Folks, that we've basically had 1 minute.
Bless him.
We have to have a walkie-talkie because we're out in the shed. Can you please give me like 5 minutes to finish this recording? 5 minutes.
Don't edit that.
No. I'll put it at the end as an outtake. Oh, kids. Right. So, but that's the first time, I think.